Thanks very much and good morning. I'm going to be talking about USAID SANREM CRISP, which now they changed it to SANREM Innovation Lab, a five-year project. And I'm just going to present kind of a slice of the results that have been gathered by a large number of people. And I've put the students in bold here because that's what I'm most proud of, is we were able to train a pretty large number of students on this project. This was my first experience working in Africa, and this picture's from my first trip there. And what really impressed me going there to work on conservation agriculture was the amount of bare soil right before planting time, and moldboard plows everywhere. So, you know, it looked like Iowa before the no-till revolution back in the 60s or 70s, and either tractors or ox-drawn plows going every which way right before planting time. So these things it's a pretty steep order to change this behavior too, because these ox plows they're light, they're easy to repair, they're paid for, they usually have been handed down for at least two or three generations. And they're in this kind of cycle of tillage and soil degradation where if there's any slope at all, this is what happens. The plowed layer washes off right down to that plow pan, and you basically have to plow again to soften up the soil. If there's not a slope, we get a really hard plow pan and hard surface soils as well during the dry season. So we're kind of on this soil degradation cycle that we're trying to intervene into. For those that aren't familiar with this concept of conservation agriculture, there's three main components: minimizing soil disturbance, maintaining permanent soil cover with either maintaining residue on the surface or with cover crops, and then rotating crops are the three components that are considered. So, you know, I guess in a lot of the United States we just call it good, sound agricultural practices, but FAO came up with this concept of conservation agriculture a while back to kind of put it as a package, and that's had both positive and negative results of thinking of it that way. So there's a lot of constraints on adoption. You don't see any tillage tools besides plows there. So there's very very few, these great big hoes that really do just as much damage as a plow. Herbicides are hard to get, and the learning curves for using ones that might be available are pretty steep, and alternative crops are kind of unavailable. And also, the effectiveness of conservation of these concepts are the jury's still out in sub-Saharan Africa. We still need more R&D, good research to support policies that will incentivize better farming practices. But there's some, you know, naysayers all the time, and that's part of the negative part of having this conservation agriculture package, is it's really easy to attack. Sorry, I've got to get on to my results. So we used an approach of co-design and co-innovation, where we start out with a lot of meetings with farmers to design research, and then we had an iterative approach where we could change things based on farmer experiences as we proceeded through the project. This is one of the big issues as far as residue. It has a lot of uses, especially as feed. So by the next planting, after the dry season, usually it's gone. We had three main research questions. So how would alternative tillage treatments that eliminate plowing impact soil quality? How would alternative cropping systems impact soil quality? And then how would the combined effects? So we developed this factorial experiment around two lowland sites, one in Kenya and one in Uganda, and two highland sites, and then the factorial design with three tillage practices and three cropping systems. So it was laid out like this. We had four on-station plots that each had four blocks like this, and then in that region of that, of each of those four on-station trials, we had four on-farm blocks like this. Our study area is just north of Lake Victoria on the Kenya-Uganda border in the Mount Elgon region. Mount Elgon is this giant extinct volcano, and our four sites were basically around that, with the two higher elevation sites in the north and the two low elevation sites in the south. This is a Google shot of the Bungoma area, very high density bimodal rain, so they have two cropping seasons, so the soils really get a double whammy every year with lots of plowing. And Ursula presented yesterday that second season they lose a lot of organic matter as mineralization from plowing in those fresh residues during a rainy season. So the Kaptrowa area is just an example of one of the highland areas. It's been farmed since the 80s when part of Mount Elgon National Park was degazetted, and rich soils but high erosion. So the farmer practice started doing well right away because they're really good at this continuous maize bean intercropping, so our challenge is to try to intervene with some these other practices. Our other practices included a relay where after beans we'd go into a cover crop, and then a strip intercropping that I'll tell what that is in a little bit. But it concentrates the maize in one strip, then beans, then a cover crop instead of intercropping. So the three pieces of information I'm going to talk about today are yields, soil organic carbon and nitrogen, and then compaction that we measured with a penetrometer. I woke up this morning and our postdoc had emailed me a lot of yield data, and I tried to get it together, but I got confused and I didn't get it in here. But the main thing we've seen is that with maize, there was really no yield gap. A lot of times we'll see a depression in yields as we change from one system to another. And we've really seen, this shows data from earlier, I think the first year. So we did see, the first year we saw conventional tillage yielding more, and then the second year the minimum till and conventional yielded the same. And by the fifth year, there's no differences amongst maize yields. And we think that if we continued to use these practices, we'll see the conservation practices outperform. Now with beans, the beans already, the strip tillage and the minimum till and no-till are both outperforming the conventional practices, I think because of the introduction of that cover crop especially. Soil organic carbon, this is 3 years of data, and we split it out into two depths, but the same story all over. There was no significant differences among the three tillage treatments or the three cropping system treatments with soil organic carbon. So that's all I'm going to say about that for now. We have a lot more organic carbon data coming. We've done some very thin soil sampling, and we're still in the process, and then we're doing organic matter fractionation with that, and that was later in the process, so we'll have more data on that. But this compaction data, I think, is really interesting, and it might underlie kind of a trajectory towards a positive outcome or higher yields with these conservation practices. You know, at all four of our sites, okay, these, we have a penetrometer with a data logger on it, and it'll take a reading of the pressure it takes to push that penetrometer down every 2.5 centimeters. And so that's what this is. You can see it with this conventionally plowed treatment. It increases and increases, and then around 20 to 30 centimeters, it passes this this threshold of 1,500 kilopascals is apparently the threshold where roots can't easily penetrate. And so in each of these cases, you can really, really see that plow pan that has developed, and that's a root-restricting layer right below the plow depth. So I just put the no-till on here. So after 3 years, we can see that we have harder soils in the surface. So it took more at each depth. It took more pressure in the surface zone because we're not plowing it. We're not fluffing it up with that sort of plowing addiction. And but down into the plow pan, we see the plow pan start to disintegrate in each of those cases. So I think these are really pretty exciting results because it might underlie some yield responses that we're starting to see later in the project if roots can penetrate that plow pan. And when we're soil sampling there with a probe, that plow pan really can cause some headaches. It's very compacted, and backaches. So just some sort of more anecdotal evidence. Towards the end of the project here this last summer, we interviewed everybody that was involved, and there's really a lot of excitement about this strip intercropping approach with like 4 to 6 rows of beans, 4 to 6 rows of macuna, and then 4 to 6, macuna is this viney leguminous cover crop that we were using, and then 4 to 6 rows of maize. Farmers have noticed that the macuna suppresses weeds into the next crop, the maize follows the macuna, and that they really get a yield bump, and that's what we're hoping our data corroborates with that. So what we really started to talk about and what they're excited about is this idea that instead of not fertilizing or really under-fertilizing your whole acre, if you plant maize on a third of the acre, you can put on the optimal amount of fertilizer, you can concentrate your weeding efforts and really maximize the yield in that third of an acre and probably produce as much as you would by intercropping the whole acre. And they see that. A lot of times they can't even get to the whole acre that they planted with weeding because the weeds are in the tropics. If you've never tried to stay ahead of weeds in the tropics, they're pretty intense. So there's a lot of excitement about that, and that's where I think we're going with a next phase of this project. And that then leaves room for building soil on other parts of the field. And so this strip intercropping concept, this is from data in Iowa, but you get as much as 60% more yield because of border effects as well. So those border rows intercept more sun, the roots have more access to resources if they're next to beans or a cover crop. So we think that could also help to offset the space that they have to sacrifice for soil building. We're also continuing to develop new tools, these Oxdron multifunction farm implements. It's basically a animal-drawn toolbar that you can put sweeps on, things that to get away from the inversion tillage and leave residues on the surface. So that's all I have. These are some of our collaborating farmers that we've worked with for 5 years, and their excitement and efforts on this project really kept it going. So do I have time for questions?
Yes, you do. Are there any questions for Dr. Martin? Yes.
Have you noticed any
changes
in the nutritional benefits to the cover crops, in particular phosphorus availability?
The one cover crop we're using, I went there with the impression that there'd been a ton of work on cover crops and everybody knew about cover crops. That wasn't the case, but we chose one and used it, and it's a very fast growing legume, and I think it's velvet bean. I think it probably has a pretty high phosphorus requirement, so I think, you know, to maintain that, we probably need some phosphorus fertilization. And we were fertilizing with phosphorus. Yeah. Yes?
Is there trouble with farmers dropping out? I mean, there's like a real time delay between benefits. How do you keep farmers encouraged about participating when you don't see big results?
Well, we followed this co-innovation prescription that... there's some papers on it by Rossing. He's used it a lot in South America, where you just really, we had on the ground people that met with these farmers at least once every 2 weeks. And then we would have, you know, scientists that met with them every month or two. And so we just stayed engaged was one way, even though some of them, you know, were kind of remote. We did have some turnover, but mainly it was family land disputes, you know, that caused, well, we'd enlist one guy and then he'd say, well, that turned out that wasn't my land, so my family took it away. But, so it was less than an acre, so it wasn't their whole farm, and they kept the crops and everything. We had some farmers, one just visited the U.S. a few weeks ago, Shadrach Tuway, and some of them really got excited about it and are upscaling some of these treatments, especially, you know, not planting maize on the whole farm, but figuring out how much money they have for fertilizer and planting the amount they can optimally fertilize and things like that. And then the no-till, he's really noticed that after 4 years, the no-till really started to produce well, he thinks. So it wasn't a big issue.
Yeah. You mentioned itself, the problem of the crop residue.
Partially. Part of the reason we chose Makuna is it's, some people think it's not a good forage. It depends. With our farmers, it depends who you talk to. Some of them said, yeah, you know, they eat it. Goats eat it. It's great. Others said, no, they won't eat it. And so that's good and bad in a way. But, you know, I'm really starting to think that just getting the plow out of the system is at least as important as maintaining surface residue. Maintaining below surface residue at least is half, you know, maybe half the story. And by getting the plow out of the system after 4 years, we're starting to see that come around. Because even if you don't feed corn stover and things, the termites and just the high respiration rates, the stuff just disappears, you know. So, yes. Yeah, and we tried to do it when the soil, you know, a day or two after a rain when the soil was at near field capacity was when we were doing that. Because otherwise, there's just no way. You'd have to drive it in with a sledgehammer. So.
Even after the no-till, I can see where that surface was more dense than you indicated, harder.
Well, yeah.
Did it make it that much harder that even under no-till you had to drive it with a
sledgehammer? Well, you just couldn't really do it in dry conditions,
right.
And I don't think that's even recommended. The method calls for moist conditions,
yeah.
Typically. So.
So, is there a measurable difference between moisture content and no-till?
You know, we did infiltration rates, and I'm not answering your question because I can't remember. But we did infiltration rates, and I took that out because there were no significant differences or it was faster under conventional till. So the penetration differences aren't showing up yet in infiltration rates, at least, our saturated hydraulic conductivity. So, but I would expect that to start to show up, but it's not showing up yet. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Dr.